Yeah, so it's a great pleasure to be back here in Toronto, and I've really enjoyed all the discussions I've had with listening about research and talking to some of the young students before this talk. So I'm going to tell you about some recent developments in the field of solid-state physics or condensed matter physics. These developments have to do with the appearance of topology and quantum entanglement when we study solids. And in some ways, the study of solids is a very old field. And to see really conceptually new ideas appearing in trying to understand these solids, that has been very exciting for us. So I'll try to convey some of that some of the reasons why we are so excited. But to do that, I have to first tell you what the conventional understanding of solids and phases of matter was, and why this represents, why these new developments represent such a major break from what we knew before. Okay, so my talk has three parts. Let's see how far I actually get. So the first part will be about an introduction, which will tell you, try to place this in the context, the historical context of how we understood the states of matter. And then I'll tell you about three new developments. One will be about quantum phases that involve topology in solids. And I'll then tell you, there'll be two parts to that, and then I'll tell you about how quantum entanglement plays a role in trying to understand these new phases. Okay, so for many years, we have sort of known that when you take many particles together, take a many-body system, you can get new physics. Okay, new physics that's not a property of one or two or three of these particles. It's really something that emerges when you have billions of these particles that come together. And one of those new phenomena is that we get phases of matter. Okay, we get these really distinct states. You go from one state to another. There's something singular, something sharp that happens, and that's a phase transition. Okay, and so this, people spend a lot of time exploring the new physics that appears, and that sort of goes under the, this very nice phrase that more is different. Okay, there's something new that emerges when you have many particles that's not contained in the properties of individual particles, and these are sort of the many different phases of matter. We are used to solids, liquids, gases, and so on. But there are also more exotic phases that you get when you, cool systems down to low temperatures, superfluids, Bose-Einstein condensates. Well, we know about magnets, maybe new exotic phases. So there are all of these different states of matter. And the question is, how do you sort of think about the distinction between them? And for a long time, people thought they knew what the key distinction was. The key distinction had to do with symmetry. Okay, and that was a great discovery, that you can really understand phase diagrams, what different phases your system can have, simply by thinking deeply about symmetry and how it could be broken. Okay, so so the first person to really point this out and extract all the physical consequences was Landau. So he came up with this very precise measure of symmetry, what's called an order parameter. I'll give you examples of that. Which will tell you whether a particular symmetry that you have is present or not in your system. Okay, so the most basic example is the distinction between a liquid and a solid. Okay, in a liquid, if you take any point inside the liquid, it looks like any other point. You have molecules that come by that point. As a function of time, pretty much every point in the liquid looks the same. Okay, now a solid is very different. Okay, in a solid, in a crystalline solid, the atoms or molecules, they occupy certain positions inside that solid. Okay, not all points inside the solid are the same. Sometimes you're close to an atom. Sometimes you're deep inside one of these cubes. The different points really look different. Although, if you look at the physics of the system, the interactions between particles and so on, they're completely democratic about the different points inside the solid. Okay, so you have a symmetry at the level of the underlying physical law, but the state of your system chooses to break that symmetry. It chooses to pick certain points for the atoms to lie and certain points where there are vacancies. Okay, so the distinction at the fundamental level, the distinction between a liquid and a solid, is really one of symmetry. solid has chosen to break the isotropy of space, whereas the liquid preserves that. Okay, and there's a way to make this sharp. You can look at the density, and that's really the order parameter, okay, whether the density is uniform or has these fluctuations. Okay, so if you go from a liquid to a solid, you either have the symmetry or you don't. Okay, and there's no gradual way in which you can change that. So that's really the phase transition between a liquid and a solid, the freezing transition. And there must always be a distinction between these two states simply because they differ at the level of symmetry. Okay, now, you can also ask, what about liquid and a gas, right? We think of them as different phases of matter. How do I characterize the distinction between a liquid and a gas? Okay, and, you know, at ambient pressure, if you look at liquid water and water vapor, it seems like there's really a very big difference. Okay, the density, for example, is a factor of 1,000 different between the two. But if you ask in terms of symmetry, is there any difference in symmetry between a liquid and a gas? The answer is no. Okay, there's no real distinction at the level of symmetry. So Landau would tell us, actually, these are not really different phases. Okay, there's no qualitative distinction between them. The distinction that we're so used to is really just a quantitative distinction. The factor of 1,000 in density, that's a big factor, but it is a number. Okay, it's a quantitative distinction. Okay, and as you might expect, there is a way to go from the gas to the liquid without ever actually going through a phase transition, without actually going through a boiling transition. So if you extend this phase diagram, what you find is that the phase boundary between a liquid and a gas actually stops at some point. Okay, this is actually occurs at high pressure, so we're not very used to seeing this. But at some point, the distinction, this big density distinction, begins to go down and down and down till it's eventually zero. And beyond that, you can smoothly go from a gas to a liquid. Okay, there's no significant, there's no clear-cut distinction. And this is in line with the thought that truly distinct phases of matter are ones that differ at the level of symmetry. Okay, so people thought they had this really figured out, and in fact, this theory of Landau gives you a very powerful way to actually tell which state of matter you're in. Okay, so this order parameter is a is something that you can measure. For the particular example I gave you, the order parameter being the density, you can use X-rays to measure this order parameter. People do that with crystals, and you can figure out exactly in which way your symmetries have been broken, okay, in which ways the solid has broken the symmetry. It also lets you classify what are the distinct states that you can get. Okay, I give you a symmetry, I tell you it's broken. What are all the different ways in which you can break the symmetry? It turns out that for the symmetries of space, the translation symmetry of space, there are exactly 230 ways in which you can break the symmetry. Okay, so those of you who have taken a solid state physics course, you may recall, maybe with some traumatic memories, actually the enumeration of all of these 230 ways. Okay, but the beauty is that there are a finite number of ways, maybe there are many, but there are exactly 230 different ways in which you can break the symmetry. That tells you that the number of different crystals you could get. Okay, so you find a crystal anywhere, on Earth, on Mars, wherever, it's going to fall into one of these 230 space groups. Okay, so people actually did this classification before they really could tell you with certainty that solids had a crystalline structure. Okay, so you can solve the mathematical problem. Today, actually, we know that every single one of these space groups is realized by some material or the other. Okay, so that took a while. It took the development of this very efficient way of figuring out the space group of a material. But now we're at the point that every theoretical possibility has been exhausted. Okay, so that gives some of us hope. Maybe we have these crazy theoretical ideas. Maybe we go and make these classifications. We may not even have a single example when we begin. But in course of time, hopefully, we'll have the same kind of success as people had with this idea of symmetry breaking. Okay, and the key, of course, was that they had a good way of telling experimentally and theoretically what the distinction between these phases are. Okay, and for the kind of new phases that I'll talk about, we are still grappling to find such a distinction. And perhaps the idea of quantum entanglement may play the same role as what the order parameters did for these old phases. Okay, there are also many practical applications of this old theory, this Landau theory. You can derive phases, phase diagrams, calculate them. Usually they're shown for very practical applications like phase diagram of, I don't know, zinc and copper or something. The solubility of zinc and copper, but I found a nice one while looking on Google Images. So here's a phase diagram of chocolate and vanilla. Right? So of course, very, very key application of this Landau theory. So it's a great theory. It does extremely well. For a long time, it was thought that all phases of matter you can understand like this. But there's one slightly disappointing outcome, if you like, which is that all of these phases that are understood in terms of symmetry breaking, which have this kind of order parameter, in some sense, these phases are all classical. So although the constituents that go into making this phase, the atoms, the electrons, and so on, they are extremely quantum mechanical objects. They're described by the laws of quantum mechanics. Once they get together and form this ordered phase, the description of that phase itself is in terms of a very classical object. When you describe, for example, the magnetization of a ferromagnet, that's an order parameter too, you just talk about it like a classical vector. So even phases like superfluids. So if you take helium, take helium and cool it down to very low temperatures, it displays this amazing phenomenon of superfluidity. It can flow without any friction. If you hold it in a bucket, it actually climbs up the walls and comes down. It can do that without really paying any penalty against friction. So it has all of these amazing properties. Even such a phase is ultimately thought of as a classical phase. So once you reconcile with the idea that atoms are waves, so once you're okay with that idea, this phase is really a phase of classical waves. It's very much like light. We describe it in terms of a classical wave, Maxwell theory. the superfluid state of helium is really what you can, all of these properties you can predict from a classical theory where you emphasize the wave description of the atoms. So you might have hoped that you take many of these quantum particles together, you'd get a phase which has truly quantum mechanical properties. Its fundamental properties are somehow reflect its quantum underpinnings. So what I'll tell you is about some of these new phases that we are excited about have this property. The key structure is somehow truly quantum mechanical. So we'll mainly be interested in states of matter at low temperature. So for a theorist, I'll just say temperature is zero. And until recently, so maybe not for some of you, but for many of us, until the 1980s is still recent. Until recently, all of the experimentally discovered phases you can essentially understand from the symmetry breaking picture. What I'll talk about now is what happened in 1980 and why that really represents a conceptually new way of thinking about the states of matter. So in 1980, the integer quantum Hall effect was discovered. So what does that mean? You take a two-dimensional system. They actually took some semiconductor, but it's not important exactly where it was found. It's now seen in many different systems. You apply a voltage in one direction, and you also apply a magnetic field. Now, if you didn't have a magnetic field, if you apply a voltage in this direction, you also get a current in the same direction. But with the magnetic field, you can measure, you can do this Hall measurement, which is to apply voltage along this and measure the current along the perpendicular direction. And you can take that ratio. That's a bit like doing a resistivity measurement, but it's an unusual kind of resistivity. And what was found is that in that resistivity, instead of simply having a curve as a function of magnetic field, you get a very strange-looking curve. This curve is actually sticking along certain plateaus, and if you ask exactly what these plateaus are, what is the value of the resistance at these plateaus, it turns out you can relate it to the fundamental constants of nature, Planck's constant and the electrical charge of the charge on the electron, times some integer. This n is an integer, so n equal to 1 means that the resistance over here is exactly this combination of the fundamental constants. And it's not just that this is close. This is extremely accurate. In fact, up to one part in a billion, you find this this quantization holds. So the big surprise, the first surprise is, you take this very complicated system. It's got atoms, it's got electrons, it's got some interactions and so on. But at the end of the day, if you look at the right properties, which in this particular case is the Hall conductance, there's a very simple answer to what is happening. The answer is take the fundamental constants of nature times an integer, that's the resistance that you're seeing. Okay, so the question is, how can you get such a simple and robust behavior from this very complicated system? Okay, another thing that which was another conceptual outcome is that if you look at the state of these electrons along at this field or at that field, these are can really be thought of as different states of matter. Okay, because if you go from one to the other, there's something sharp that happens. You can't gradually go from one to two. There must be some sort of jump in between. You can think of this as a phase transition, and these are two phases. Okay, but these two phases are not different in any symmetry way. Okay, they have the same symmetry. Nevertheless, you have two phases, and there's no way to go continuously from one to two. Okay, there's, if this number is always an integer, you have to jump. So this is an example of a pair of phases that share the same symmetry, yet they're distinct. Okay, and the distinction ultimately is not one of symmetry, but one of topology. Okay, and in the next few couple of slides, I'll try to explain what how topology, which is really some mathematical way of thinking about, say, surfaces, how that comes into the discussion of the phases of matter. Okay, so if I were to give you just a one-sentence definition of topology, so topology is a way of thinking about objects in a very forgiving way. Okay, you don't really think about small distinctions between objects. You know, you really just look at the very big picture. So you allow to make deformations of your object. Let's say your object is a surface. You're allowed to deform the surface in many different ways, but you're not allowed to tear it, okay, or try to glue parts of it together. You're just allowed to make these smooth deformations. So if I give you something like this, a sphere and a bowl, they're actually topologically the same. You can take one and squish it, and then sort of make it into this bowl. There's a continuous way of going from here to there. Okay, but there's no continuous way of going from this orange to this donut. Okay, you've got to punch a hole in the center to go from here to there. So if I make smooth deformations, I'll never go from here to there. So as far as topology is concerned, this one, this set of states is different from this one. Okay, but it forgives any distinction of this kind. Okay, so you may have seen the slide, this kind of picture before. I've added, this is the main addition that I've come up with. There's a number two as well. So it's two handles, two holes punched into the surface. That's yet another topologically distinct surface. Okay, so so in fact, let me mention one more thing, which is sort of nice to make this analogy. So Gauss, many years back, figured out a very beautiful way to tell how many handles the surface has. Okay, of course, you could just look at the surface, but for that, you need a global view. Okay, you need to be able to view the entire surface at one go. But suppose you could only make measurements at the local scale. Okay, so for example, we wanted to know if the Earth as a whole had one handle or zero handles, okay, or what was the topology of the surface of the Earth. Okay, so what he figured out is that you can measure the local curvature. Okay, simply figure out what the curvature is in one little part of the system, and then integrate that curvature over the entire surface. Okay, so you might think this will give you some complicated result, but if you use the right definition of curvature, the Gaussian curvature, this simply gives you the number of handles, this g over here, times 4 pi. Okay, 1 minus g times 4 pi. Okay, so there's a way to compute the topology of this surface by measuring curvatures. Okay, so now what is the connection to the phases of matter or the quantum Hall effect? So it turns out that topology is giving you this sort of discrete series of states, and so it's a natural language to describe states of matter. Okay, so this the action of doing something drastic, punching a hole or something, is akin to making a phase transition, okay, where something drastic happens. And the things that are separated by phase transitions, you can make small changes and go between them. They are individual states of matter. Okay, so it's not, at some conceptual level, not surprising. There should be a connection between topology and understanding the phases of matter. Okay, but you need an example, and the quantum Hall effect gives you an example. Okay, so number one and number two, the distinction is in terms of the topology. It's like this genus over here and that genus. Okay, and in fact, there's a closer analogy. There's something like the curvature that you can integrate. It happens to be not in the real space, but in momentum space. I'll come to this in a little bit. And you integrate the relevant quantity, and you end up getting exactly the integer n that characterizes this quantum Hall state. Okay, so physically, the characteristic of this topology, of course, it's this the measurement we talked about before, but there's actually a more intuitive way of thinking about it. If you look at the orbits of electrons in a magnetic field, they tend to be circles. Okay, the electrons circle in a magnetic field. That's fine in the interior of the sample, but as you get to the edge of the sample, the boundary of the sample, these electrons can't complete the circle, and they end up smashing into the surface, getting reflected, and they keep doing that. And if you follow what happens, they kind of skip along the edge, and they end up giving you a mode that moves along the edge of the system. Okay, so in fact, this integer n is simply the number of these modes that move on the edge. Okay, and they have a particular robustness because they only move in one direction. Okay, they move in this direction on this edge, the opposite direction on the opposite edge. Okay, so if you're like, it's like a one-way street, and when electrons move just in one direction, you can't really move, you can't really scatter them backwards. Okay, there's no way, there's no channel to send them back. So this ends up giving you this very precise measure of conductance. Okay, so so this is really the physical manifestation of this topology, that in the center of the system, there's nothing much happening, nothing very interesting going on. The electrons are just circulating around. But when you emerge emerge at the boundary, you find that something interesting is going on. You find that electrons are channeled into just these one-way propagating modes. Okay, and that's going to be a theme that will continue in the next part of my talk. Okay, so this quantum Hall effect, you have to work somewhat hard to get it. You have to get these very clean samples where you confine electrons to two dimensions, apply a strong magnetic field, and so on. So you may ask, is this effect kind of simply realized in some solid? Okay, pick a solid, and if I want to understand the physics of the solid, is some feature like this simply present without actually, a lot of engineering? Okay, so that's really been the new the news in the field, that in fact many solids have properties very similar to this quantum Hall effect. Okay, and many of them are pretty well-known solids. They were just lying around on people's lab benches. They just didn't know what to look for. Okay, so the best known example are these topological insulators. So these are just some three-dimensional solids, and one distinction from the quantum Hall effect is that you don't apply a magnetic field. Okay, some effect like a magnetic field is internally present simply by the spin-orbit coupling, the way in which the spins of the electrons are coupled to their motion inside the crystal. Okay, and at the end of the day, if you have the right pick the right solid, I'll give you some examples, you end up with a topological phase, which is in some ways similar to this quantum Hall effect. Okay, so again, like in the quantum Hall effect, if you go deep inside the solid, it doesn't look like a very interesting system. Okay, it looks like some insulator. I'll talk a little bit more about what we mean by that. But then when you emerge at the surface, you find there's something interesting going on at the surface. Okay, if you look at the electrons at the surface, if you plot their energy as a function of momentum, they have this sort of cone-like dispersion. The energy is proportional to the momentum, and it gives you this sort of dispersion. And it turns out that if you had a purely two-dimensional system, not the surface of a three-dimensional system, but just like a slab in 2D, you could never get a single, you could never get electrons with this particular energy-momentum relation. Okay, you could never get one of them. Okay, so this realizes something that's impossible in 2D, although this appears to be a two-dimensional system. The surface appears to be two-dimensional, but because it's attached to the bulk, it has some special properties, and it can realize this interesting state. Okay, and one of the very interesting manifestations is that if you end up putting impurities on the surface, things that will scatter the electron, usually when you do that to a metal, if you keep raising the number of impurities, the amount of dirt in your system, you end up stopping the motion of electrons in a metal. Okay, it turns into an insulator. Okay, it turns out this surface state is special. If you do that for the surface state, keep adding impurities, the electron finds ways to go around the impurities and preserves the physics of this particular dispersion. Okay, there's a caveat here. There's a symmetry that has to be preserved, time reversal symmetry. But with that caveat, this is immune to impurities. Okay, so the hope is that maybe we can utilize that fact It's not happened yet, but that's sort of an intriguing thought. Okay, so there are materials now, this material that involves bismuth and tellurium. And if you look at its surface, there's an experimental technique to actually map out this energy momentum relation. You see this nice Dirac cone. Okay, and this material actually was known for a long time. So it's a well-known thermoelectric. Okay, so if you pass a current, you can actually get heating or cooling, depending on the direction in which you pass the current. So people used to use it in these PCR machines to heat and cool in a very specific way. So I guess there are many biology labs that had this topological insulator sitting inside. Okay, so we just didn't know what subtle property this topological phase would have. That's actually a characteristic of many of these topological phases. You know, topology itself is sort of a subtle property. You really need to know the entirety of the system to specify the topology. So often the physics, like over here, the surface state physics, is something subtle. People just didn't calculate the surface states when they did electronic structure calculation. They didn't probe it maybe in experiments, or they didn't know that this was special. You're getting something like this was special. Okay, so the hope is that many of the crazy ideas that I'll tell you about in the rest of the talk, there are actually examples of that. They're sitting in some lab bench somewhere. It's just that we don't have very good ways to probe the physics. Okay, or it's not as direct as some of these symmetry broken phases that I talked to you about. Okay, so I'm sure you've heard something about these topological insulators. So I'll focus on related phases, which are somewhat distinct. The distinction that we'd like to emphasize is whether we have an insulator or not. Okay, so what is an insulator? So this is an operational definition of an insulator. Apply voltage, no current. The way in which something like diamond works, the reason it's an insulator, if you look at the electronic, the way in which the electrons are arranged inside diamond, you have this periodic potential of the atoms. When the electron moves through this periodic potential, you get bands. You get certain forbidden regions of energy where there are no bands. And if you have exactly the right number of electrons, you can end up filling these bands, the so-called valence bands. And then there's an energy gap before you go to the next set of allowed energy levels. Okay, so if you try to apply a weak electric field, you can't really excite these electrons, and they don't move. Okay, the state stays the same, so there's no electrical current. Okay, on the other hand, in a metal, you, for example, partially fill these bands. Okay, the electrons are not filled up all the way to the band gap, so if you apply an electric field, you can deform the exact states in which the electrons are present and which they're absent. You can generate an electrical current. Okay, so people have discussed topological properties of such insulators. Okay, and the question is, can we have metals or something that conducts, which can also show some topological properties? Okay, it turns out with some few caveats, you can extend it. And I'll give you an example of this, of a three-dimensional phase, which is a semi-metal. So essentially, it's a metal. But we'll see that the number of electrons that can actually carry a current will be very small. Okay, so it's sort of something close to an insulator, but actually on this side. Okay, and if you're familiar with graphene is a two-dimensional material, which has all kinds of amazing properties. What we'll talk about here is a three-dimensional analog of graphene. Okay, and it will also have some topological properties, which I'll tell you about. Okay, so these states are called wild semimetals. To give you an idea of what these states are, imagine I have this energy and momentum diagram, and these are the states that the electrons occupy, okay, the bands that the electron occupy when they move in a crystal. Also, I'll assume these things are non-degenerate, you just have this pair of bands. And over here, I have an insulator. Okay, if I fill electrons up to this level, it's an insulator. But what I can do is I can imagine deforming parameters so that the band above intersects the band below. Okay, now what happens is that you have low energy excitations where the electrons at the place where the electrons stop filling the bands, and this actually is a metal. Okay, in fact, if you do it carefully, the excitation spectrum that you get is near this crossing point. Okay, that's where the low energy excitations of this system lie. So if I blow up this crossing point, if you look at the energy versus momentum relation, the energy goes linearly with the momentum, if you're close enough to that point. Okay, so in fact, it turns out that the excitations describing electrons near this point was discovered many years back. Okay, it applies in this case, like it often happens in physics. You have one equation that describes many cases. So this equation was described by Hermann Weyl when he took Dirac's equation for the electron. That was a four-component equation. And he assumed that, let me forget about the mass of the electron. And he came up with this equation, which is just a 2x2 matrix equation. Okay, so these are Pauli matrices, and they describe these two bands, and the energy goes linearly with the momentum. Okay, so it turns out the same equation describes excitations over here. I found this famous quotation of Hermann Weyl. I didn't know it was due to him, but I think he was one of the early people to say that, you know, if he had to choose between truth and beauty, he would actually choose beauty. Okay, so maybe for that reason, there's no known excitation that satisfies the Weyl equation. Okay, so people thought the neutrino was a Weyl fermion until they discovered that the neutrino has a mass. Okay, and if you have a mass, then you can show that there's no way to add a mass to this Weyl equation. Okay, it always describes excitations that are massless. So the neutrino is not a Weyl fermion, and the question is there anything in nature that's described by this Weyl equation? Okay, and we are hoping that maybe in solids you will get a state where, at least for the low energy excitations, the relevant equation will be this Weyl's equation. Okay, so so I'll tell you about possible physical realizations, but before I do that, I want to sort of connect this this particular state with what we were talking about before. Okay, we were talking about topological states. Why is it that when bands intersect in this particular way, I get a topological state? Okay, what's topological about that? Okay, so so for that, I have to give you a very simple picture of what Berry curvature means. Okay, and this is something new that emerges when electrons move around in a periodic potential, like, for example, the potential that's set up by atoms inside a crystal. Okay, so if I just think about the motion of a particle, motion of an electron, for example, so let me write x and k. I'll call k the momentum. So the velocity of a particle is simply the derivative of its kinetic energy with respect to momentum, right? And the force that a particle feels is the gradient of some potential. Okay, so if you look at the equations of motion for a particle, they're kind of symmetric between position and momentum. Okay, now what spoils the symmetry is if you apply a magnetic field. Okay, in a magnetic field, there's a force that the electrons see, the usual Lorentz force, the velocity across the magnetic field, but there's no corresponding term over here. Okay. So the nice thing about thinking about electrons in a solid is that the symmetry is restored. Okay, it turns out for electrons in a solid, when you write down a similar kind of equation, there's an anomalous velocity term. Okay, there's some analog of the magnetic field. Let me call it B tilde. It's not the real magnetic field, but it plays some analogous role, where this will affect the velocity through a cross product with the derivative of the momentum. Okay, so this term occurs in solids, and I guess I don't have time to actually tell you the precise way in which it occurs, but there's an interesting connection to the Berry's phase. If you take an electron through the states in a crystal, it acquires a Berry's phase. It acquires a phase that's not simply the time evolution, and the way in which this Berry's phase changes as I move through these states is what gives rise to this B. Okay, so if you want to be precise, it's the curl of this Berry's phase. Okay, but anyway, when you have this setup, you have this additional term, and you have this nice symmetry. Okay, so this is sort of analogous to a magnetic field, except that it's now living in the momentum space. It's something that the electrons feel in momentum space. Okay, so there's another distinction from the usual magnetic field. The usual magnetic field, if I take the divergence is always zero. Okay, there are no magnetic monopoles. Okay, but it turns out this B tilde doesn't have the same property. If you take the divergence of this analogous magnetic field, it can actually be non-zero. You can have sources and sinks of this magnetic flux, and those turn out to be exactly these Weyl points. Okay, so the monopoles of this emergent field of this magnetic field-like object, the monopoles are and the anti-monopoles are really the points where these bands cross. Okay, and that's really the connection to topology. There's something like a topological defect. At one point, the magnetic field lines come out, and the other point, the magnetic field lines go in. Okay, the magnetic being this B tilde. Okay, and those are precisely related to these wild points. So as you can emerge, as you can guess, there are lots of topological properties that are associated with that. and one of the, I'll mention two of these topological properties. One is, again, this familiar property that although deep inside the sample it looks conventional, if you come to the surface, there's something strange that happens. Can I also mention another property that's been known for many years in the particle physics context, the chiral anomaly, which now becomes something that we can experimentally try to measure. Okay, so what is unusual about the surface? So if you look at the electronic states at the surface for one of these wild semi-metals, it turns out that the set of states that you get forms an arc. Okay, so it connects the points in momentum space where you have these band crossings. And having an arc for a Fermi surface is really unusual. Okay, if I had just a two-dimensional system and I asked what does the Fermi surface look like, the set of states which have the same energy, that's always a closed curve. Okay, so you just take some surface and you cut it at some particular with the surface, you'll always get a closed curve. But over here, if you just look at the, say, the top of the sample, you get something that's open. Okay, so the way in which this is ultimately reconciled is that if you look at the bottom of the system as well, there's also another Fermi surface, another arc, and taken together, these will form some closed curves. Okay, so top plus bottom is a legal Fermi surface, but as you grow this this three-dimensional system, the top and bottom states, surface states, get separated. One gets half of the Fermi surface, the other gets the other half. Okay, so if you were to generate, if you had to find one of these materials, you were to look at this excitation at the surface, you would see this very odd property. There's only half of this Fermi surface present. Okay, so that's a topological property, and there are various experimental probes that you could apply to see this. Okay, the other topological property which is interesting is related to this observation in particle physics, that if you had a single one of these wild fermions, and you were to couple it to an electric and a magnetic field, you discover that the number of particles of this, number of these wild fermions is no longer conserved. Okay, so what this equation tells you is that if I just count the number of particles I have in the presence of an applied electric and magnetic field, that number is changing with time. Okay, so that's one reason why you can't have a single wild fermion. We always have this pair. So if I were to realize this wild semi-metal, you have a pair of these wild fermions. One of them, their number would increase. The other would decrease. So taken together, the total number of electrons is not changing. But essentially, what you've done is you've transferred electrons from one of these points to the other. Okay, so there's sort of a polarization developing in momentum space. Take electrons from here to there. And this is something that could be used, in some, to generate some interesting electrical properties of these materials. Okay, so usually we know that if you have a metal, you have Ohm's law that holds. You apply a voltage, you get a current. But once you have this additional feature present, these two species of electrons, you can get something that goes beyond Ohm's law. So let me quickly flash one idea that we had. You could probe whether or not you have this wild semi-metal by this electrical measurement. You apply an electrical voltage over here in the presence of a magnetic field, and then you look for a current far away from this the application of this voltage. Then in a regular metal, what would happen is that there's no voltage far away. It rapidly dies down. But in one of these wild semi-metals, you can argue that you can pick up a voltage very far away from this. You can pick up a current very far away from this if there's a magnetic field present. Okay, so there are various new properties that you get for these materials and which may have some applications. So people are thinking about ways to do logic, to do computation, but without using the charge of the electron. Okay, so nowadays, of course, we just use transistors and so on, which use currents, but you could sort of save, for example, on power if you use some other degree of freedom of the electron, for example, the electron spin, and maybe even this distinction whether the electron is in the right or the left point. Okay, that's called valleytronics. Okay, so maybe there are some applications. Just the fact that you get new electrical properties means that it could be useful someday. Okay, so so all of this would happen if you could get a realization of this system. And there are various things that have been proposed, materials that have been proposed. So this is one family of materials that has been proposed where you can do some computational, you can compute a phase diagram, and there's some region of the phase diagram where this phase is realized. And there are groups here. Stephen Julien's group is has a candidate material which may be in this phase. Okay, we're still not sure. Okay, and so there are various other proposals that have been made which seem quite realizable, but this particular kind of material, this wild semi-metal, has not yet been unambiguously discovered. Okay, but a small variant of it has, we believe. There's something called a crystalline wild semi-metal. I won't really go into the details, but there's sort of a doubling of these wild points that it turns out also to be a valid phase. It's protected by some additional symmetries, and there are some recent experiments on, for example, this material, sodium bismuth, which seem to have experimentally observed this particular phase. Okay, so things are developing very rapidly in this field, but it may be we already have some experimental realization of this kind of physics, and it'll be interesting to see all of these topological properties emerging. Okay, so so all of this physics that I've talked to you about, there's all of these topological properties, but they've emerged in rather simple models. Okay, in fact, that's part of the reason why we have been so successful in identifying experimental candidates and actually verifying this in experiment. So all of these properties you can understand without worrying about the interactions between the electrons. You can just think about one electron moving around in a periodic potential, figure out the properties, and they're essentially independent of one another. Okay, but it turns out there's a vast number of topological phases that emerge once you start including the interactions between particles. Okay, and so I'll talk a little bit about that. Phases of matter that have topological distinctions which appear when you have strong interactions. Okay, and the simplest model that we know where we can include strong interactions is a quantum spin system. Okay, so on every side of this lattice, you have a spin. It can either be up or down. You can think of it as a qubit, if you like, one or zero. And then you couple these spins together. Okay, for example, you can say the spins like to be pointing in opposite directions to their nearest neighbors, and so on. And that defines for you the simplest interacting phase that you can think of. Okay, now, of course, if I took a large number of these spins and I cool it down to low temperatures, you can ask what is the state of matter that you would realize. Okay, and of course, there are some very conventional-looking states of matter. You could have a magnet. Okay, the spins could align along some preferred direction and freeze into that sort of orientation. That's just a magnetically ordered phase. And such a phase can be described in terms of symmetry breaking. Okay, the spins have broken the symmetry of pointing along any direction. They've chosen a direction. Okay, there are some other phases which are slightly less obvious. For example, a spin can pick a partner. Okay, now you have a pair of spins, and together they can form a singlet state. Okay, they can get entangled, form a state which is up, down, minus down, up. Okay, those are these blue things I've shown in blue. And those pairs can occupy the entire lattice. And it turns out this also is a symmetry broken state because it breaks the symmetries of the square lattice. Okay, it picks certain directions to pick a partner. Okay, now there's a more interesting possibility, which is a quantum spin liquid. So you do something like this at the local scale. You pick a partner and form one of these singlets. But then these singlets you can think of making quantum superpositions of these singlets. Okay, so a picture. Let me change the lattice a little bit. So this is a triangular lattice. You again have neighbors that are formed into singlets. But because of quantum mechanics, you can fluctuate. These singlets can fluctuate. And you can make a quantum superposition of all of the different ways in which these singlets can lie, can find neighbors. Okay, and it turns out such a state is a very interesting phase. It's called a quantum spin liquid. So the analogy is this is like a solid. It's picked a neighbor, broken symmetry. This is more like a liquid because it's fluctuating around. Okay, but this is quantum mechanical. And you can ask, what are the properties of such a spin liquid? And it turns out that it has some very interesting properties. Okay, so one of the amazing properties it has is that you can make excitations that carry the basic unit of spin, okay, that carry just the spin a half. Normally, if you have a spin system, if I take a downspin and make it point up, the difference that I've made is one unit of spin. Okay, minus half goes to plus half, that's one unit. But in these phases, you can show, like this cartoon diagram shows, this you can actually make excitations that carry just half of that spin. Okay, so what you do is you take one of these singlets, make them into a triplet, make them spin one, but then you take the spins at the ends of this triplet and drag them apart. Okay, so those are the two defects that you see in this picture. And it turns out in one of these spin liquids, the energy cost you pay to drag them apart is something very small. Okay, so you can really think of these as independent excitations. Okay, whereas in one of these solids, spin solids, if you try to do the same thing, you end up with a bunch of these bonds that are sitting in the wrong place. Okay, all of these green bonds now have to be picking the opposite partner, and you get a string of these green bonds. The further you move away, the more of these green bonds you get. Okay, but these green bonds are in the wrong position. They're not aligned with the rest of the lattice, so you pay an energy penalty every time you make one of these green bonds. Okay, so the further away these spins are, the longer is the string of green bonds, and the larger is your energy penalty. Okay, so in a spin solid, actually, these spin a halves are tightly bound because to pull them apart costs a very, very large amount of energy. In fact, the energy grows linearly with the separation. Okay, so, so in fact, this may remind you of something which is confinement of quarks. If you take a pair of quarks in QCD, try to pull them apart, the energy cost grows linearly with the separation. Okay, and it turns out there's a very close analogy. Ultimately, the physics, the mathematics used to describe these two states has a very close resemblance to gauge theories. Okay, things like QCD. It turns out that this is the confined phase of the gauge theory, where the quarks are tightly bound together, and this is the deconfined phase, okay, where if you realized it in QCD, you would have free quarks. Okay, of course, the theory itself is somewhat different. It turns out that this is sort of like electrodynamics, which is a gauge theory, but this is electrodynamics where the electric and magnetic fields can either be one or zero. Okay, it's like a binary electrodynamics. And in this situation, you can actually have a condition where you can separate out these quarks to large distances and not pay very large energy costs. Okay, so so ultimately, the physics that describes the state of matter, if you really look at it at long scales, is really a gauge theory, although to begin with, you just had spins that interacted with one another. Okay, so people have postulated maybe the fact that we see gauge theories in nature, it's not a fundamental ingredient. Maybe at the very smallest scales, you have spins on a lattice, perhaps, but it's very natural to get these kind of theories. We know other models where they emerge. Perhaps this has something to do with what we see in nature. Okay, so of course, that's sort of a bold suggestion, but it's interesting to see that you can naturally get this kind of a theory from rather simple models. Okay, and so I won't really spend time discussing exactly what the ingredients in this gauge theory are, but where could you see such a phase? Okay, are there solids where we could see such states? And it turns out a very good candidate is spins on this particular lattice. Okay, it's called a Kagame lattice. This name comes from a particular kind of basket weave in Japan, and people have actually found materials where the spins lie on this particular lattice, okay, on exactly this lattice. And when you look at a theoretical representation of this problem, you can do a numerical study, see what happens when I have spins that are coupled together on this lattice, and you find that there's no sign of any kind of symmetry breaking. Okay, all of the symmetries are preserved. It's a candidate for one of these spin liquids that we talked about. Okay, but of course, in order to definitely identify that this is a quantum spin liquid, you need something like this order parameter. You need something that will tell you for sure that you're in this particular phase, and that gets me to the last part of my talk, which is quantum entanglement. Okay, so the proposal is that if you really look at how the spins are entangled with one another, there's a way to tell for sure that you're in this particular state. Okay, so Okay, so let me give you a very brief introduction to this this idea of quantum entanglement. And you can start at a very simple level. Let's say you just have two of these spins or two of these qubits. And let me say I have a state like this. Okay, one of them is in zero, the other is one. So we have some idea of what entanglement is. Entanglement is really the key ingredient that makes quantum mechanics weird. So if you didn't have any entanglement, if you didn't have this possibility for things to be in an entangled state, quantum mechanics would be very, very simple, very intuitive. States like this are not entangled. You can say the first spin is zero, the second spin is one. Okay, but this is an example of an entangled state. When this is zero, the other one is zero. When that is one, the other one is one. You know, what state is the first one in? Well, it really depends on what the second one is in. Right? That's really the heart of weirdness in quantum mechanics. Okay, so we need a measure for this entanglement. Looks like we have a measure already, how many terms we have in this expansion, but that's actually misleading. If I write on a state like this, it looks very, very entangled, four terms in the expansion, but in fact, you can rewrite it simply in a different basis as simply the product of two states. It's just along the x direction rather than the z direction. Okay, so you really need a measure for entanglement, and one measure that people have come up with is something called the entanglement entropy. Okay, so so what you do is you take a part of the system that you're interested in, let's call it region A, you trace out all of the degrees of freedom in B. Okay, this is operationally what you do. You write down a density matrix that tells you what the particles in the region A are doing. Okay, now when you have a state that is not entangled, for example, 0 and 1, the first spin doesn't care what the other spins are doing. Okay, you do this procedure, you'll find that this entropy is zero. Okay, but for the other case where the spins are entangled, they care a lot about what the other spins are doing. Tracing this out gives you a very large entropy. Okay, now, you can think of entropy intuitively as your ignorance. In the first case, you have no ignorance about what the first system is doing. In the second case, where they are entangled, you generate a lot of ignorance once you get rid of the other system. Okay, so so you can use this measure of entanglement, and you can take different states of matter and ask how entangled they are. Okay, and it turns out this gives you a way to identify these exotic states that I talked about, these topological phases. Okay, just like an order parameter allows you to identify broken symmetry phases. Okay, so the details of how you would identify, for example, a quantum spin liquid is you take a region A, you calculate its entanglement entropy, and do it for different size regions. Okay, and it turns out that if you look at how this scales with the system size, or the size of this region A, there's a trivial term, which is simply the perimeter of this region A, but then there's a subleading term. Okay, and it turns out the subleading term only appears in these interesting topological phases. Okay, and it tells you somehow that the degrees of freedom in this state are entangled across very long scales. Okay, and that's really what you measure when you measure this entanglement, this constant in the entanglement entropy. Okay, and in fact, people have done numerical calculations for this particular model I talked about, this Kagame lattice, and they verified, in fact, that this constant that you get, they did it for different system sizes, they extrapolate, and they find that, in fact, that constant that you get is very close to the theoretically expected constant. I think it's within a few percent, and verifies that what we had over here on this Kagame lattice is indeed this particular quantum spin liquid. Okay, so of course, this is much harder to figure out than one of the conventional phases, but it's gratifying that there is a well-defined quantity, and at least in numerical calculations, it can be measured. Okay, and the big question these days is there an experimental way to measure this quantum entanglement? You know, that's not, there are proposals, but nothing that's going to happen in the next few years. Okay, so that was for a numerical simulation of this system. Is there really a material? So in fact, there's a very promising candidate where you have these spin a half moments on a Kagame lattice. Okay, that's this so-called Herbert-Smithite. So this is, of course, named after a person. So his students apparently found this material and named it after their advisor. So I tell my students the story repeatedly, hopefully that they will do the same thing. So what Herbert Smith's students found is that this particular material, they found this very nice mineral. There's a picture of it over here. You can't quite see the colors, but there are actually some green colors over here that tell you that it has copper in it. Again, copper is an element that often comes in spin a half. So recently, people have looked at the properties of this material. And in fact, they verified that it doesn't have any magnetic order down to very low temperatures. Okay, so it's a candidate for this kind of quantum spin liquid state. There are some differences from the detailed properties seen in numerics, but that may be due to the crystal not being perfect. Okay, so this may actually be a realization of this quantum spin liquids. I guess I'm almost out of time, right? Okay, so I have just one more point that I'll make, which is, why would it be interesting if you found a quantum spin liquid? Okay, so there's one very nice idea that was put forward 2 decades back. We saw that in these quantum spin liquids, there are spin a half excitations. Okay, so what happens is that the electron also has spin a half, but it has a charge as well. The excitations that you see in the quantum spin liquid only carry spin a half and no charge. Okay, so in a way, what happens is that the electrons in the quantum spin liquid break up. They break up into a particle that carries charge and one that carries spin. Okay, so what was observed theoretically is that you could also have a breakup of the other feature of the electron, which is that it's a fermion. Okay, so the fermion-ness of the electron could either go to the spin or it could go to the charge. So imagine that the spin excitation is fermionic, then this, you have a chargey particle, which is a boson. Okay, so we know that bosons can Bose condense. And if you figure out the Bose-Einstein condensation temperature of electrons, it's enormous. Okay, it's like 1,000 degrees if you have the density of electrons in a solid. Okay, so the idea was that this may be a way to achieve high-temperature superconductivity. Okay, if you have electrons that can move around in a quantum spin liquid, they could break up like this, give you a bosonic excitation, which could then Bose condense. Okay, now if you put in the numbers, the kind of electrons you could introduce over here, the transition temperature comes down, but it's still in the hundreds of Kelvin. Okay, and we don't know if this is actually can occur, but this is an interesting route to realizing high-temperature superconductivity, okay, which is why people are interested in finding these quantum spin liquids and then hopefully introducing extra electrons, which can then give you a superconductor. Okay, so let me just conclude now. So we talked about the history where solids have been thought about in terms of spontaneous symmetry breaking. But maybe in the future, we'll see that topology and ideas like quantum entanglement are more important. And what we hope is that what we have already seen, all of these topological phases, is really just the tip of an iceberg. There are many more phenomena waiting to be discovered. And maybe we'll have to change this kind of slogan to quantum is different. Okay, we're getting new phenomena and truly quantum phenomena when we look at certain materials. Okay, so let me stop over here.